very prevalent in the world and was very prevalent in Tibet for about 800 years. Then I saw that there was something on the lower Indian school's idea of Buddha nature, like Abhidharma schools and mind-only school. So I thought to throw in some of that. Okay, so we'll start there. The first is Abhidharma school. Okay, this is the lowest of the four great schools of ancient India, Vaibhashika, detailist school. And I thought to tell you what they think is Buddha nature. Okay, and each of these gives you, like, I wouldn't have done this probably in the original 18 courses because a lot of today's lecture is on wrong ideas. But, because people would remember them and maybe they'd get a bok chak for them. But I think in the in-depth courses we can start to go into controversies and arguments between different schools. And when I was in the monastery, it was very rare for one of my lamas to pull out an actual book from another school and let them speak for themselves. You know, like in the monastery textbooks, it's always, they think such and such. And it's often presented as sort of retarded. And it's not so bad when you read it from the other textbook's view. So what I've done is I've actually taken some other schools' textbooks, and you'll be getting a presentation from them. But let's start with the Abhidharma, okay? They talk a lot about this kind of Buddha nature. And there's a Sanskrit which you'll get in early October. Say, Pape?
Pape.
Rick.
Pape?
Pape.
Rick.
You should be able to translate that. Yeah, the Buddha nature of an Arya, okay? The Buddha seed of an Arya, say, of a person who has seen emptiness directly, okay? And here's how they describe that Buddha seed. The letters are looking good. Anyway, say, Duchung,
Chokshe.
Duchung,
Chokshe.
Duchung means, I think you know this expression. I think we had it in one of the earlier courses. This is a very famous expression in the Abhidharma Kosha. Duchung means few wants. Few wants. Like, don't need much. Chokshe means happy with whatever you get. Okay, Chokshe means satisfied. Santosha, right? It comes as one of the niyamas in the Yoga Sutra. Okay? And they pull this out of the Lotus Sutra. And there are four kinds. Let me see. One is to be satisfied with whatever clothing you get, like just rags. One is to be satisfied with wherever you have to stay or sleep. One is to be satisfied with whatever people put in your bowl, like whatever you have to eat, right? And then the last one is to be happy just sitting around all day doing Dharma. Like, Pongwalagawa means happy to work on your mental afflictions, happy to study, happy to do your practices, you know, satisfied with those four things. Happy to do that. So why would that be Arya seed? Buddha nature. Yeah, and further, you see? So, in fact, in some cases they might even describe an Arya as being this kind of a person, rather than working on emptiness perception or something like that. So anyway, you get the idea that for them, a realization in the Hinayana schools, very monkish, Vinayish, is satisfied with a little room in the corner and some rags to wear and whatever to eat and sit there and do your practices all day. That's basically Hinayana ideal. Okay, so they say the reason they call it Buddha nature or Buddha seed is that this is the sine qua non. If you don't have this, you can't get anywhere else. That's just the beginning, you know. Then they say Shen Da Chi Mu means, needless to say, everything beyond that. But you got to have this to start with, or you're never going to even come to Diamond Mountain. Okay. All right. By the way, they also say that the Dodepas, the sutras, accept this. So this is a Buddha nature according to the two lower schools. Okay. Now we'll get to mind-only presentation of Buddha nature. Say Sakme, Semgisaben. Sakme, Semgisaben. Sakme means pure, undefiled. Semgisaban means seed in the mind. Seed in the mind. An undefiled mental seed. Pure mental seed. And there's basically three steps to developing a mental seed. Ter sam gom. Say ter sam gom. Learning, like what you're doing right now. Contemplation, which you should be doing in the car on the way home. And then gom, meditation, which you should be doing tomorrow after you get your homework that says meditate 15 minutes on such and such, which I'm sure you're all doing. Okay? That's sakme. Those three steps, ter sam gom, are necessary for all Buddhist development. Start learning, then contemplation on what you've learned, and then meditation on what you've contemplated on. There's even a bodhisattva vow, right, that you have to do that. If this seed has not been developed through those three processes, but you have it, then that's the first kind of Buddha nature, right? Natural, rangshinirik, natural Buddha nature, innate Buddha nature, the one that everyone's born with, okay? If this seed has not yet been acted upon through those Buddhist processes of learning, contemplation, meditation, then it's called natural Buddha nature, okay? If the same seed has been acted upon in that way, it's called developable Buddha nature or developing Buddha, okay? So they also make that distinction. The lower two schools don't make that distinction much, but the mind-only school does make that distinction. That's a little bit different from what we had, right? And just to repeat what the Madhyamika had, right? Prasangika especially. The natural Buddha nature was what?
The emptiness of the mind.
Mostly the mind. Your own emptiness, mainly of your mind. Yeah, your own emptiness, mainly of your mind. Okay? And then the developable was things like path of seeing, or, and in tantric way, even your five heaps, like, could turn into, right? So, see how it differs from the mind-only school's version. It's important for understanding what else we're going to talk about tonight, okay? So get the difference straight. Mind-only school thinks there's some like little crystal seed inside of you. And then if that's been acted upon, or whenever it's acted upon by learning, by the process we're going through right now, then that's going to help you develop into a Buddha. Insofar as it hasn't been acted upon, or the part that hasn't been acted upon, the part that's been with you all the time, well, that's natural Buddha nature. You see? So it's kind of like a part which is being acted upon and a part which is not being acted upon. And it's sort of like a crystal seed within you. Okay? So the native crystal seed that you've always had is natural. Then the seed, as it starts to get acted upon or develop or cultivated, that it appears they believe that that same seed becomes a kind of developable Buddha nature, okay? But I don't think they would say that you lose the first seed when you start on the second seed, okay? Like, somehow you still got both of them, all right? And there's a lot of problems with this idea, and you'll see some debates in your reading. I stuck in some debates between Madhyamika and mine only about why this is not such a great idea, okay? And we'll talk about that. Well, you can read about it in about 4 or 5 weeks. Okay. I'm really ambitious with the readings. They're going to end up huge. And I was reflecting that it's probably even good that instead of having this be your last Uttara Tantra class and then you don't get one until a week before you teach, that you get the readings and then you'll read them, and I'm sure in between, and, you know, digest them as they come out. Okay, that's my real idea. Okay. Sorry?
Remember when he said...
Yeah. You can actually, if you're careful, you can find everything in the readings. You know, they'll be couched in much more formal language and debates and arguments, but you can thresh them out. Which brings us to Shentong. This is now... Oh, the first thing I ever put up today was Vaibhashika and Sutrist. South Trantika. The next thing I put up was mine only. Now we're on to Madhyamika, right? Which is, everybody in Tibet says they're Madhyamika, right? And Shentong, write it down first. Shentong is an idea about emptiness that spread in Tibet from about 1100 on, okay? Its roots can be traced back to about 1100. And it became very popular, the practice of Shentong as how to practice about emptiness became a very prevalent in many schools, mainly in the Kagyu, to some extent in the Nyingma, even in some Sakyas. Shentong became the way to meditate on emptiness. And then it was attacked very seriously by Jetsun Kapa, Gyaltsab Jay, and everybody after them as being very mistaken. So today we're going to cover Shentong. First I'm going to cover Shentong as if I was a Shentong, okay? And Shentong means emptiness of something else. Shen means something else. Tong means empty, okay? It's not only a view of emptiness. It became a movement, you see? So Shentong is not only a name for a kind of emptiness. It's a name for a way of thinking about emptiness. And it became a movement. And the movement was strong for a while, and then died for a while, and then came back, and then died again, and like that. You can say there were three even peaks of it in Tibet, say around 1300, and then around 1750, and then around 1870s, something like that. Okay, there were like peaks where it was defended very strongly. And so, as I promised, you're going to get to hear from the textbooks, and most of the reading is from the other textbooks of other schools. I wanted to tell you which textbooks, okay, so that you know it's authentic and you know that. The first one is called, say, Sammo Nangden. Sammo Nangden. Sammo Nangden means the deep inner state. Dun means state, Nang means inner, Sammo means deep or profound. Deep inner state. And it's a book about really chakras, channels, drops. It's a beautiful roadmap of the inner body. And we're going to use it when we get to course 14 or whatever it is in the Tantric series. And there's a group of people working on it already. It's a really, really good book on the inner body. And its author is... say karma, Rangjung, Dorje. Karma here has nothing to do with karma in Sanskrit, okay? It's karmapa. This is the karmapa. This happens to be the third karmapa, okay? The karmapas are a great, one of the great traditions of the Kagyu lineage, okay? And the fourth karmapa, for example, who's the most famous Kagyu we know? Yeah. Jetsun Kapa. Okay? Okay? Just like Jesus the Jew. Right. He was a Kagyu. Jetsun Kapa was a Kagyu. Although he had a great Sakya teacher, Rendawa, also. But the fourth Karmapa actually is the one who gave Jetsun Kapa his first vows back in East Tibet. So we have a very strong connection with them. Rangjung means happens all on itself. Lundrup means self-produced. When you see Buddhas that you showed me one that come out of a rock, you know, like you just see a Buddha outline profile in a rock, or a Tara comes out, those are called Rangjung. Rangjung means just happened, came out on its own. Okay, and Dorje means diamond. It's an appropriate name for someone who's into Shentong, which you'll find out later, because you could read this as, you know, self-produced wisdom of the diamond. You know, so it's not a bad name for someone teaching Shentong. We're going to be reading. The readings you get are actually from a commentary by someone named Jamgun Kongtrul, who died in 1899, for example. I'm going to write his name next because he's the author of the second text we're going to read, which is different from the commentary to this text. Get it? He wrote two books that we're going to read. The commentary to this one, and then his own book, okay? And this part was translated by Winston Ha. And it's really nice. It's a big section in the text. He's been working on it for a while. Say, Shentong, Dati, Dawei, Dorje. Okay, Shentong means, again, that special kind of emptiness which became the name for the whole school, okay? Dawa comes from Dawa, meaning what? Yeah, view or worldview especially, okay? Ti means in book of instruction. Tati is a special genre of Tibetan literature, which is a book about emptiness. And there are lots of tatis. It just means a book about emptiness. Okay. A book about emptiness, the version of emptiness called Shentong, which means emptiness of something else, something emptiness of other. I call it other emptiness in the reading. Okay. I call it other emptiness in the reading. Although I don't like weird words like that in general, you know. Okay. Dawa means moon, as you know. Dorje means Dorje, diamond. It means the diamond moon. I translate it as the diamond moon. The moon is important to Shentong people because of the image of the mistaking the image of a moon in a quiet pond for being the moon itself. Like if you go to Alistair's house and you go out behind and there's this pond swimming pool. On a quiet night, you might look down and see the moon, and you know, for a second, you think you're looking at the moon. So there's this idea of illusion, okay? And the absence of that, the non-existence of the moon in the pond, is emptiness, you see, which is the diamond. So it's the appropriate name that he gave his book, The Moon of Diamond, or The Diamond Moon, or something like that, okay? I'm going to give you the author's name. Say Jamgun. Kongtul. Jamgun. Kongtul. Jamgun Kongtul was a very interesting figure. I mean, to become so famous so early, right? Usually you have to be dead for 400 or 500 years before you get famous in Tibet, or before they carve your books, you know. But he was like some extraordinary thinker. He grew up in a very troubled time in Tibet. There was a lot of fighting between different religious factions. He got caught in the middle of that in several instances. He was one of the rare Tibetans to become a real master of letters in his time. I mean, he became a great writer. Like out of 500 monks in Gyurong College in Seremei Monastery in 1959, there were only two who could write. Okay? I mean, but he was pretty great writer. To me, his style looks a lot like Jetsun Kapa's. I think he must have studied Jetsun Kapa's scriptures a lot because he takes Jetsun Kapa to task a lot. Okay, he has quite different views from Jetsun Kapa, but the way he presents things and his language is very similar. It's like someone who really absorbed Jetsun Kapa and wanted to emulate Jetsun Kapa in a way. And I think because of the trouble that he had grown up in, he started a movement called Rime. Rime means non-aligned movement. And they tried to sort of bring the sects together by drawing from different books. Like, he drew a lot from Nyingma texts and he drew a lot from Kagyu texts. And so a lot of the debate was going on between different sects of Kagyu. And that's a long story, but basically the Kagyus are split into four or five great lineages, like Shangba Kagyu, Karma Kagyu, Jigun Kagyu, Drupa Kagyu. These are all like different groups of Kagyus. And a historian I once spoke to, what's his name, Matthew Kapstein, who's a great Nyingma Kagyu scholar, said that he felt it was because of the geographical isolation of the different parts of eastern Tibet. The Kagyus were big in eastern Tibet. And then there were huge valleys. Like, it took a lot of trouble to go over the pass into the next valley. And so these lineages sort of took on their own characteristics. And there are a lot of differences between the presentations after a few hundred years. And then there came to be some, you know, friction. And also, just in general, between all the schools, especially Galupas and Kagyus, in certain periods of Tibetan history, there were some bad times. So I think Jamgun Kongtul and someone named Mipham, who lived about his same time, they were very interested in trying to heal this kind of division and trying to bring together the different philosophical ideas and trying to show how maybe they weren't so unacceptably different after all. And so he's known as a great master of the Rime movement, which was, you can think of him as a synthesis between Kagyu and Nyingma, but mainly Kagyu. Okay. He's also known as Yundin Gyatso. There's also a Dalai Lama named Yundin Gyatso, so don't get confused. And Garwang Lodrutai. I don't know if this is the god of Garchen or Gar Monastery, but I think it might be. Garwang would mean like Prince of Gar, And I think Gar is an area in East Tibet, okay? So we're going to study his, that's the author of the second book we're going to study, okay? This book is really cool. I mean, I asked Gene Smith, who's a follower of Shentong himself, okay? This is one of the greatest scholars in the West. I asked him, give me the best book on Shentong, because I want to put it in the reading, you know? So he sent me Jamgon Kongtrul's book. And I started to read it, and it's very beautiful because it's not very long, it's like 25 pages or something. But the first half is all about Shentong theory. And then the second half is how to put that into action in your daily meditations. So it's kind of a neat, I mean, the concept of the book I find very refreshing. You know, the first half is all this philosophy and debating and argument, and then the second half is, okay, suppose you actually want to get this view in your own mind. You know, well, here's some practical meditations you can do based on scriptures, you know. So he made little meditations where you would recite something from his favorite book, which what from India, which might be what?
Uttaratantra.
Uttaratantra, okay. He's got all these sections from the Uttaratantra. You can't see the Buddha. You can't hear the Dharma. You can't bow down to the Sangha. Now meditate on that, you know? So he would take, maybe out of context, I don't know, but he would take pieces out of Uttaratantra and say, okay, that, meditate on that for half an hour. And then, so it's kind of a neat book where the first half is like debates about philosophy, and then the second half is like practical meditations to do about Shentong, and mixed in there is some Chulam Gyanendra, like what to do after your meditation until your next meditation, you know, as you're walking around. So personally, I find that a really beautiful method of presenting atati. And I haven't seen it much like that. It's kind of nice. You know, like there's a whole long section on how to meditate on this thing. You see what I mean? Okay. Jamgon Kongtrul in his book, first he goes through the history of Shentong. And he says it traces its roots back to, guess who? Well, that for sure. Maitreya. And Maitreya's five books, and especially Maitreya's Uttaratantra, okay? And then he says, look, there were two great translators, which are called Sua and Tsen. And I like the way they interpreted Uttaratantra. If you read the catalogs of the Kangyur and Tengyur and other catalogs, these two translators were working on which text? Uttaratantra, okay, like this was their specialty. Also, they were working on, and their lineage were working on Kalachakra Tantra, which has a lot of connection with the inner body and the environment, as we spoke about at the Tiger Rider. There's a big presentation there about how your environment is a reflection of your own channels. So it's natural that these lamas would be interested in the Kalachakra and interested in the Uttaratantra, okay? So then he traces it up to Tibet, and then he says, look, there were three great lamas who really are the fathers of the Shentong tradition. I wanted you at least to know their names. I'm not going to do them in Tibetan. I'm just going to write them in English, okay? So you don't have to do it in Tibetan on your homework. The first one we already had, actually, right? He's considered the forefather of all forefathers. Ready? Rangjin Dorje? Okay, and those are his dates, and you already know about him. Then the omniscient, say Dulpoa? Shirab? Gyantsen. There's something you have to know about him. He was a few, well, I'll tell you about that later. Anyway, later on, this school gets another name, okay? The people who were in love with Shentong idea got called Jonangbas. Okay, Jonangbas. And oftentimes in Gelugpa scriptures, especially in Jetsun Kapa, you'll see, oh, the Jonangba says that, but, you know. And then he'll argue with him. So the Jonangban, right, is whenever you see the Jonangban, like the big Jonangba, it means one guy out of a school that went on for 800 years, right? It's number two here. Like, okay, whenever you see the Jonangba, whenever you say, oh, Jonangba says that, but who could believe that, okay? It's by Jetson Kapa is referring to Dopua Sherab Gyantsen. Okay. And we'll talk a little bit more about Jonangba, about the idea of Jonangba. He's interesting because he was originally a Sakya master. And then he got converted to Jonangba. He got converted to Shentong. He believed it, and he went for it. Then there's Longchen Rabjamba, who was a great Nyingma master, and got converted to Shentong. Okay? So he's one of the most famous Nyingma scholars. Like, you'll often see Longchen Nyingtik, famous book by the Longchenba. He's also named, you'll see him in the reading as Chime Uzer, which is one of his other names. Okay? And this is his days. So these are the important fathers of the Shentong tradition listed by Kongtrul Rinpoche. Okay. Now I'd like to talk a little about I just want you to know the history. You know, people, you should know. I mean, every teacher you ever meet in the West will be from one of these traditions. And you should be able to know the differences, you know. Pavoka Rinpoche got mad at his disciples one day. He said, "What's the difference between Nyingma and Gelugpa, you know?" And they said, "Nyingmas wear a red hat, Gelugpas wear a yellow hat." And he's like, you know, he's like, you know, like nothing on the ideas that are different, just the hat, right? Okay. And I'm afraid that a lot of people are like that, okay? I'm afraid that a lot of us are like that. I'm not saying right or wrong, bad or good. We're going to talk about that at the end, okay? But you should know the differences, clearly, you know. You should know what you're talking about. Like, you get in a room with some Kagyu students and you start talking about karma and emptiness, they're going to get confused. They're going to say, "I never heard about that," you know. And then they're going to start talking about Shentong and you're going to say, "I never heard of that," you know. And you should know the differences and you should be able to argue the differences. That's a basic thing. Why do these differences exist? Because people think of these things. So it's good to know all the ideas that people have thought about because it might pop up in your head a year from now. And there might not be anybody to ask. So it's good to anticipate the problems that your own students might have. The ideas about emptiness that might pop up in your own students' minds. I mean, sort of in America, luckily we've gotten beyond the black abyss idea of emptiness, or that it means nothing at all or something like that. But then we got to overcome other ideas like, oh, just think about nothing and you'll get to emptiness or something like that, you know. You don't have to study, you don't have to analyze, you don't have to think. Just close your eyes and float, you know, and emptiness will come to you, you know. Don't think about anything, you know. And we have to be able to talk about those ideas. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the tradition called Jonangba. Through which the Shentong lineage passed. Then we'll get to the ideas. Roughly, it's like that, you know, something like that. And, you know, here's Nepal or Bhutan, I don't know. India's down here, right? And Lhasa's around here. And then right here, there's a town called Shigatse, which is a famous town to stop in on the way to Lhasa from India. You know, it's like the biggest city between Lhasa and India. It's the only city. I mean, and it's where the British attacked, for example, in the early 1900s, which communists ended up attacking Tibet, but that's another story. And right around here is a place called Jomolung. There's a pass called Jomolung, and a monastery was built there. So they shortened it to Jonang Monastery. Jonang, Gumba, which means Jonang Monastery. Okay. That was built, well, let me tell you first. The lineage goes like this. First is Jomolung is the county. It's like Cochise County. And then the mog drops out when you make an adjective at it. So if you want to say Cochise Countian, Virginian, you just make it Jonangba. Okay. So it means originally it meant somebody from Jonang, somebody from the valley of or from the area of Jonang. Okay, the county of Jonang. Okay. Of Jomolung, actually. Okay. This lineage begins, the Jonangba lineage, in some texts, okay? I mean, the main text that I've read, it says that Yumo, say Yumo? Mikyu Dorje. was the one who really started the Jonambas. They don't know his birth date or his passing date. He lived to 82 or something like that. But he lived in the 1000s, okay, the 11th century. He wrote some books about Shentong and pretty much got Shentong started. Okay. It sort of spread slowly, and then a couple of generations later comes along Tse Kunpang, Tukche, Sundu. Kunpang means gave up everything. Sometimes they call it for, sometimes yogis are called that, hermits. People go out and live in the wild place with no money and stuff like that, called Kunpang. Tukche Tsundu is his name. And he's the one who actually built Jonang Monastery. Okay, so he's like the second big guy in the Jonang tradition. He said this is worth building a monastery over. Okay. Probably they had four guys. I mean, now, you know, later it was a big monastery, but at the beginning it's just usually a 30 by 30 building or something, okay, whatever. All right. He built the first monastery called Jonang. Then you have Tse Dupua. You just had him on the last list, okay? 1292, 1361, something like that. Okay? The Jonangban, okay? He got so famous, like he was so persuasive. He was such a good debater. And he presented the Shentong system so well that it's practically named after, I mean, he's given the name of Jonangba. So when you read Jonangba, the Jonangban, they're talking about him, Doboa. Okay? So those were that's sort of the historical development of this particular monastery where Shentong thrived and where Shentong started to spread. Okay? From there. Then it goes into sort of a decline. After the 1300s, it goes into a decline. All right? Until Taranatha. Okay? Taranatha is very famous. Taranatha, he's Tibetan, okay, but he has an Indian name, okay? Like Taranatha means Dhamma protector, Tara protector, right? Gun. And he's very well known for his history of Buddhism. Your first reading had some excerpts from him, which Elihu had to type in, okay? And he's also very famous because he went to Mongolia and taught Buddhism there. Like, he was one of the big figures in Mongolian history. So when you talk about Buddhism in Mongolia and about their view of emptiness, you get a big Jonangban push in Mongolians' views of emptiness. Okay. There's a modern lama. Say, Jetsun Dhamma. I told you the story of the phone call I got, right? The guy says, I'm the Dalai Lama of Tibet. I'm Mongolia. And I'm like, sure. No, I'm like, oh, I never heard of you. You know, he says, I'm Jetsun Dhamma, you know. And I said, well, where's your monastery, Ulaanbaatar? Oh, he says, I've never been to Mongolia. And I'm like, okay. Well, what monastery are you from? He says, well, I never became a monk. And I'm like, and you're the Dalai Lama of Mongolia? He says, yeah. I said, well, you know, he wanted to meet me in New York. And somebody wanted him to meet me. And I'm like, well, you know, I'm kind of busy, you know, maybe we can meet some other time. And, you know, and I hung up and I went home and told Rinpoche about it and laughed about it. And he says, oh, you made a big mistake. He is Jetsun Dhamma, you know, he is the Dalai Lama of Mongolia. And he was living in a small village in southern India his whole life after the fall of Tibet. And His Holiness recognized him but kept it secret and kept him secret because they feared for his life. Because Mongolia became communist, and if he had returned, there would have been a big problem. So, and he had children. I mean, he had a wife and children, and he never became a monk. And his kids were in Gyalwon Kamsen, in my house. And we used to debate together. And one of them was the monastery truck driver, and one of them was the first diamond factory manager. But he's considered the reincarnation of Jetsun Taranatha. And when we got to Mongolia, we saw this huge palace near the highway, and I said, whose is that? You know, and they said, that's Jetsun Dhamma's house. You know, and I'm like, oh boy. And he had never lived there. He had never been there. And then recently he was able to go back and spend some time there. Now he's considered the main lama in Mongolia. Okay. But I just thought you'd like to see how Taranatha comes up. This is considered a Galupa reincarnation, so it sort of shifts into a Galupa reincarnation. So now that you know what Jonangba means, okay, It's a place. Monastery got named after it. Famous guy from that monastery got called Janamba. And then it kind of died out and then kind of revived. When I mentioned a revival in 1700, I meant a revival in 1575, okay? I made a mistake at the beginning. I couldn't remember Taranatha's dates. But he spearheaded the big revival in the 1600s, say, early 1600s, okay? I'd like to talk about Shentong and what it means, okay? And here we get to the nitty-gritty. I mean, we're finished with the background stuff, okay? I was very anxious to get this book from Gene Smith because I thought I'd dive in and find an explanation of why Shentong is called Shentong. Because I know the Gelugpa version, but I thought it would be really interesting to see the Kagyu Rime version. And then I've gone through the text pretty carefully. I don't think he ever says why Shentong is called Shentong, okay? So I was sort of disappointed. But then I found another very definitive reference, and then cross-checking, I think it's the best one I've seen. I think it's a really good one. Which is to say, there's three... You got to know something about the Shentong people. Some of them consider... I think you could say they consider that the three turnings of the wheel are not the way you always learned it from Winston. As far as to figurative and literal. They think it's different, okay? They have a different take on it, okay? Very interesting. And this is a big debate with Jetsun Kapa, okay? First turning of the wheel, we all agree, was figurative or literal?
Figurative,
by anybody's standards, okay? Lord Buddha didn't talk much about emptiness, didn't clarify anything, okay? Second turning of the wheel, Lord Buddha said, nothing has any nature of its own.
Literal
according to Majjhimika, right? But the Jonambas would say mixed, literal and figurative. Okay? And then they get to the third turning of the wheel and they say definitely literal. Because they're very big into mind only. Okay? And you can see how they're sort of coming out of the mind only school. They are really fixated on Uttara Tantra. You know, they really believe in Uttara Tantra. Okay? They really believe in the five books of Maitreya as being a message that the world is mind only. Okay? But they don't call themselves mind-only, okay? They believe in the mind-only school, but they don't call themselves mind-only. They believe in Majjhimika. If you ask a Shentong person, are you mind-only or Majjhimika, they say, we're Majjhimika. We're the great Majjhimika. And they distinguish between the plain old Majjhimika and the great Majjhimika. And they say, we's the great Majjhimika, okay? Even those old Majjhimikas back in India are just regular Majjhimikas, okay? We're the great Majjhimikas, okay? And they do draw their system from Indian sources. I mean, they say, we believe in the Uttara Tantra especially, and we believe that Maitripa brought it to Tibetans. Who is Maitripa? Do you know? He was one of the other guys hanging out in Nalendra while, guess who was there? Naropa. I mean, I believe Maitripa was even one of the guards of the gates, as Naropa was. But anyway, they were hanging out together in Nalanda Monastery. After Naropa went away as a yogi, resigned from the abbacy, it was taken over later by his student, guess who? He was sort of a stickler. He's a little more conservative. Lord Atisha, okay? So you got Lord Atisha and Maitripa in the same monastery. Maitripa is this great tantric yogi who really liked to do a wild sechu. And we have records that he was actually disciplined by Lord Atisha for his wild sages, you know. And he kind of said, you know. Then one of Marpa's teachers, whenever Marpa wasn't around Naropa, he would go hang out with Maitripa. And Maitripa also taught him Tantra. So anyway, if you ask a Shentong or a Jonamba, who's the big Indian scholar that you follow? We say, oh, we're straight Maitripa. Maitripa's version of the Uttara Tantra is what we're selling, you know. And Uttara Tantra is Majjhimika. But the way they present it is pure mind only. Okay? So that's, you start to get a feel. So what is the basic, what are the most, Winston, somebody else. What are the most important three ideas of the mind only school? Whoa. Say again?
Contact.
Shenwang. Yongdu. Those of you who study with Geshe Thupten Rinchen, I mean, it was a mantra, right? Kundai Shewan Yongdu, Kundai Shewan Rinchen. Okay. Here's us. Here's them. Okay. What's Kundak mean? Somebody else. In one word.
The consciousness that...
No. Constructs. Constructs. Imaginary things. Like, things that are in your mind. Okay? You could say constructs. Okay? Mental constructs. Like, there could be a person who irritates me that wasn't coming from myself. Is a construct. The person who irritates you, who wasn't created by you. Okay? The person who shocks you or bothers you, who didn't come from you, okay, is a construct. Two kinds of constructs. What? Some do exist and some don't exist. I mean, that one doesn't happen to exist. Okay, that's just a plain old mental fabrication. You can think of this as a mental fabrication. Okay, no such thing exists. Shenwang. So kundak happens to mean like nominal, construct, fabrication of the mind. Okay. How about Shenwang? Anybody over here? Huh? Yeah. Shen means other. Wang means power. Means under the power of other things. You can call it dependent things or changing things. Anything that's caused by another thing and therefore depends on another thing for its existence. In the way that a tree depends on its seed. Okay. So we can call it depending things or. You could call it, we're going to call it cause things too, or changing.
You don't want to call it other powers?
I don't know, it gets a little weird. People forget what it means, you know. But you can, when you teach it, you can call it that and then explain it, you know. It depends on how much of a lingo you want to invent.
And my heard other powers.
Yeah, before. And I just want to say that the more you go into another lingo to present ideas, the more people you lose. When Buddhism becomes a lingo that you have to learn, that the English is Vajrasattva takes his Dhammaru and goes with his Dorje to talk to, you know, and then you already got three words and you don't have a word yet that an English speaker would know. And then they're just like, you know, you gotta remember that. Words that are familiar to you after 5 years or 10 years of study, your students aren't going to know necessarily. So you want to back up into normal English as far as you can. Okay. Okay. So depending things, caused or changing things. Yongdu, anybody? Emptiness. It means totality, right? Because what? It's all related?
All pervasive.
All pervasive, good, yeah. Yeah. It covers everything. Emptiness is called totality in the mind-only school. Because it covers the totality of all things. It spreads to all things. Everything's got its own emptiness. Okay? Everything's got its own emptiness. How many of these things are deceptive reality and how many are ultimate reality?
First two are.
According to us, say, Majjhimika. Galupa Majjhimika. Yeah. These two are normal reality. Let's call it normal or deceptive reality. This all has a point, don't worry. And this one is ultimate reality. Now we get to them. Okay? Yongdu, according to Karma Rangjun Dorje and everybody else, is the wisdom. Okay? Get used to it. Get used to it. We're wearing Shendong hat tonight. You gotta defend it, you know, like it's your life, you know. What's Yongdu? Wisdom of non-duality. Non-duality of what? Subject and object. What do you mean they're non-duality? They're the same thing. There's no separate subjects and objects. Okay? And the wisdom that perceives that perceives clear light. And that wisdom is clear light. And the wisdom mixed with clear light is Yongdu. We'll get into that. Okay? Got it? I mean, this is the big crack in the head, right? I mean, this is Winston's going, I know, huh? You know, okay, all right. Okay. So, this is ultimate reality. And it is devoid of deceptive reality. Shen Dong. These two things are Shen. Sorry, that's Shen, okay? Normal reality, which deceives you, okay? Everything in this room that you can see in a normal day, on a normal day, if you're like me, okay, is the other in emptiness of other. And this wisdom, mixed somehow with emptiness, which they would call non-duality, clear light, sorry, this wisdom mixed with their emptiness that they call clear light, is other, Shen, than these two things. So it's empty of normal stuff, okay? It's empty of normal stuff. And that's the real meaning of Shen Tong. Okay? That's the real meaning of Shen Tong. To put it very basically, wisdom or emptiness in our terms, or wisdom plus emptiness somehow, is defined as that which is empty of all the other stuff. That which is devoid of all normal stuff. Is ultimate wisdom plus emptiness. Now here's the punchline, you ready? What's it got to do with our course? What are we studying in this course? Where are we at right now in the seven diamond-like visions? We're at calm. We're at Buddha nature. What's this whole presentation got to do today with Buddha? Geshe Michael, why did you bring it? This is all very interesting. We always wanted to know the history of the I can't even remember what they are. Jonangbas. But what's that got to do with our class? You know, why did you bring that up at this point? Because Gyaltsev Jay brought it up at this point. Because Gyaltsev Jay brings it up at this point. Because, according to the Jonangbas, this is, guess what? Buddha nature. Okay? This is Buddha nature. Come on, you guys. I mean, and by the way, well, let me read it to you directly. I'm not making fun. Big mistake. Big mistake. This is very serious. Hundreds of thousands of people believed in this for 800 years. Okay. So the homework question said, like, how does the idea of other emptiness or Shen Tong relate to the Buddha nature, which is the subject of our class? Okay. Here's the answer. As noted above, other emptiness refers to the wisdom or state of mind, or wisdom. Oops. Which perceives that subjects and objects are not separate. Non-duality, right? Somehow mixed with emptiness, right? Here's how His Holiness Karma, the third Karmapa, describes it in, according to Jamgun Kongtrul. Okay, this is Jamgun Kongtrul paraphrasing the third Karmapa in his book. He says, that primordial mind, the state of indivisible ether and wisdom, ether meaning like emptiness, okay? Which is like a reflection of the moon in water. I'll say it again, okay? Beyond all true or false, that which cannot ever be identified, and beyond all names. Okay? That's how the beginner of the Shen Tong system describes Buddha nature. Okay, you ready? I'll say it again. The primordial mind, and you can read it in the reading, and this is what Winston's been working on. The state of indivisible ether and wisdom, which is like a reflection of the moon in water, beyond all true or false, that which cannot be ever be identified, and beyond all names. And later he gets like more poetic. I mean, Khonto Rinpoche says, not big, not small, not here, not there, can't be seen, can't be described. There is a unit, what? Where's it go? What is that song? Mercedes sent it to us, right? Where is me? No, it was Allison Cohen. She was driving through Texas. She hears this song on the radio. She gets it for us in retreat. We get this tape, right? There is a universe that can't be seen. Anyway, it's some guy from Texas. There's a universe that can't be seen, can't be explained, can't be beyond all sensory. You know, it's like beyond. Okay, anyway. So you immediately see one problem that any school of India would have with this idea, which is what? It's contained here. They say that this thing has been in beings since beginningless time. Okay? This purity has been in beings since beginningless time. This wisdom has no mental afflictions. It is pure. And it's been in you since beginningless time. And it is emptiness also. It is the clear light, meaning emptiness. Okay? Beautiful, beautiful, okay? So Ted says, so it's both a changing and unchanging thing? Why? What's the changing thing, what's the unchanging thing?
Well, the changing thing would be the mind.
The wisdom.
Right,
yeah.
And the unchanging thing is the emptiness.
And the unchanging thing is the emptiness. So it's already a contradiction of terms. It's like saying, it's like very weird. It's like, to say it in Tibetan is Thakpeng Lopo. Thakpeng Lopo means unchanging, functioning thing. A thing that could do its thing. A thing which could affect other objects. A pen which could write, a car which could drive, food which could feed you, without changing. Okay? Because by doing something to somebody, you what? You change. Energy is transferred. Okay? Whenever you do something, you change. So the idea here is of an unchanging functional thing. A thing that works, but never changes. Okay? And that's like a big no-no in what? Course 13, come on. I mean, big no-no since ancient India, you know. A functioning thing that never changes. What's the other example we had in Shantideva for that? Functioning thing that made a lot of stuff but didn't change.
God.
Okay, I mean, we have a problem with that. Okay? We have a problem with that. Never changes. Made everything. Okay. I mean, that's just the same idea. It's the same. So anyway, that's one of the first problems that we have with Shinto. Okay. I wanted to rub that in by quoting Jonangba. Who's Jonangba? Yeah, Sherib Gyantsen, right? Dopua. Here's his version of what it is to be Shinto. Or Buddha nature, right? They're now what? They're not like synonyms. They're now like synonyms. Okay, that's why Shentong relates to Buddha nature. Daishin Shekpei Ningbo. Buddha heart, right? Buddha essence. Here's how Jonamba himself describes the two kinds of Buddha nature. Ready? What are the two kinds of Buddha nature? Yeah, Rangshin Nemek, which is like your natural Buddha nature that you were born with, and it's always been there. And then the other one? Stuff that can turn into Buddha, right? Developable stuff, okay? But here's his definition. Ready? The natural or innate Buddha nature is an actual Buddha, complete with the 32 qualities of enlightenment, okay? Like 32 marks of enlightenment, or you can say the 32 high spiritual qualities of enlightenment. There's 64 total, actually. Which has existed for all time. As a component part of every suffering living being. Semchen, right? I'll say it again. Innate Buddha nature is an actual Buddha, complete with all the qualities of enlightenment, which has existed for all time as a component part of every suffering living being. You have a little Buddha inside of you. 100% Buddha, already Buddha, okay? And you've had it for all time. Developable Buddha nature then consists of new occasions of Buddha nature, which are created as one engages in learning and other activities like that. Okay? So developable Buddha nature consists of occasions, new occasions of Buddha nature, which are created. Like, you can think of them as new seeds that I put in your mind from my talk tonight. Okay? I mean, that's not such a weird idea, right? I'm talking tonight. You're getting certain ideas. They are certain seeds in your mind. They're going to help you grow into a Buddha. Okay? They're going to develop into a Buddha. That one's not so crazy, right? Okay? The other one is the idea that you already have part and parcel with you, a fully enlightened Buddha. So, you know, Gyaltsebje is like, I'm going to give you Gyaltsebje at the end, but I think I'll throw him in as the things go on, okay? Gyaltsebje says, look, so that means it's Svabhavakaya, right? I mean, the big one, the Dharmakaya, right? The body of essence, the essence body of a Buddha, right? Is in you already, right? Yeah. So it's got the two kinds of purity, right? Yeah. What are the two kinds of purity? A, empty from the beginning. B, free of all mental afflictions, etc. From the beginning. Okay? So if you already have a fully developed Buddha inside you, then your mind is already free in the two ways. Already dakpa, pure in the two ways. What are the two ways? One, empty. Two, no mental afflictions. Come on. Why'd you write your book? Okay? I mean, that Gyaltsebje was hot. Okay? Gyaltsebje was hot. He was not easy on people. You know, and then you can debate, you know, if this were a real Diamond Mountain September 2004, you'd have an assignment to go home to the debate ground and you know, let them defend themselves a little bit. You know, don't leave it at that, you know. And what would he say? He'd say, it's there, but it's covered. Okay? It's just covered. Okay?
Doesn't the Buddha that you become exist in all times?
Yeah, you got to save that for the debate ground. We won't get to this tonight.
If you go with the definition of developable Buddha nature according to Janamba, developable Buddha nature consists of new occasions of Buddha nature which
arise as you hear a class, etc. To Samgum, you see? And that's not such a strange idea, right? I mean, you're getting seeds planted tonight that will contribute to your enlightenment, I hope. Okay? And that's developable, you see? That's going to develop and get better and better, and then it's going to help you become a Buddha. That's okay. It's the first one that we have a problem with. There's a Buddha already inside of you. Okay? Complete with the two kinds of purity, meaning complete with no mental afflictions. The mind has no mental afflictions. You know? And then we're like, just to let you know, I mean, Gyaltsebje is really getting upset. Do you know why Buddha nature comes up at this point in the text of the Uttara Tantra? I mean, we didn't cover that. You'll see it in the reading. They say, Gyaltsebje says, how do we get to calm, you know? How do we get to Buddha nature in a discussion of, it happens to be a discussion of the qualities of a Buddha, you see, of the things you have to learn to become a Buddha. And he says, well, the idea is that all this stuff that you learn purifies your Buddha nature. You know, your Buddha nature is all mixed up, right? We said, chima danchepa. You have an emptiness of your mind, but it's stained. It's tainted. And you have to go about purifying it, right? You have to go about purifying it. So, you know, there's a debate in the Uttara Tantra. Why does calm come up here? Why are you talking about Buddha nature here? Because we're talking about purification. What's that got to do with calm? What do you think you're purifying? You're purifying your calm. You're purifying your Buddha nature. Your Buddha nature is stained. Your Buddha nature is tainted by these other things. So if you start talking about purifying, of course you're already talking about Buddha nature, calm. So that's how the whole argument starts, right? So now you're going to have to get into, well, do you have anything to... So let me get this straight. We talked about it, Christy and I talked, we were trying to thresh this out, right? We decided that Rick for this guy is a crystal golf ball. Crystal golf ball. And it's got like mud around it, you know? So what he's saying is that, look, the crystal golf ball is pure, but it's like covered with mud. Now, where would that idea come from?
Number nine.
That's not so weird. Uttara Tantra said that. Buddha image, gold with jewels and covered with mud. And then if you could just get the mud off, you could find the true Buddha inside of you, right? That's where this is all coming from. So you can feel how it's coming.
True Buddha or true Buddha nature?
Can't ask me if I'm a Jonamba, it's the same thing. But I give you this thought, and then I'll let you have a break, okay? I'm sorry, because I'm really into this. I give you this thought. See how easy it is to slip from an image into a wrong idea of emptiness. You know? See how, when you want to describe emptiness to somebody, you might say diamond, right? It was like a diamond. And then they start getting this picture of a diamond, and then after a few centuries, emptiness is a diamond. The Diamond Mountain, Diamond Bay, diamond everything, you know? It must be, I think he was saying it was like a gem, you know, a clear gem, a solid thing, you know, because the mind can't hold on to the idea of Buddha nature being the simple absence of something. You see, it's so hard for the mind. It's so hard for the human mind. And 95% of people who ever hear about emptiness are still holding on to some kind of black or some kind of diamond or some kind of clear light. You see? Instead of what have I got in my hand? Okay? No, and it's that simple absence. You know? It's that simple absence. The simple feeling you get, oh, gone. You know? It's not there. That's all. But how do you communicate that to somebody, you see, without them making an image out of it, you know? Like, that's the big thing in Islam, right? Don't make an image out of me. I'm not like that, you know? And do not make to yourself any graven images. I'm not like that. I'm a Dharmakaya. I'm just, you know? And then, but you attach to images, you know? The kernel in the seed, the world emperor in the womb, the, you know, and then you get schools going on for 1,000 years of people thinking that that Buddha nature is a seed in the sense of a positive thing, because it's so hard to hold on to. The greatest quality you have is the fact that you ain't got something that you never could have had anyway, but that you think you have. Okay, now hold on to that and try to teach that for hundreds of years, and it just doesn't go. You need something solid, you know. And I think that's where, you know, just a tiny slip in your worldview, you're here. Just a tiny slip. It's not like something crazy. It's like a tiny slip. You start thinking of Buddha nature as a seed rather than an absence. I've even used the word seed over and over in these classes just to kind of communicate it, you know. And then it gets spread that way. Okay. I think we'll stop there. Did you have a question?
Absence,
then how do you, what makes me pure? Nothing. It's an unchanging thing.
Your observations have covered that.
Then
you start sounding like
Janama. Yeah, you do start sounding like Janama. You debate it in the debate ground. Ready? No, it's a good point. Would we say that things obscured are attached to the Buddha nature that obscure it? Or is it your own perceptions that obscure it? You see what I mean? I think that's what we mean.
But if we would say that Buddha nature is something that needs to be purified in order to become...
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but what does purified mean? Can 100% emptiness, can the 100% absence of something be made any more absent? No. You see? So that can't be what purification means.
Right.
You see? So it has to mean something else to us.
Or we're thinking of Buddha nature as some sort of thing.
Yeah, it could be. Okay. We'll take a break. I'm sorry. You won't get home till too late. The Janamba school, I just wanted to go on to one more thing. The Janamba school, it's kind of shocking to me when I read it, but they say, we're the great Madhyamikas. And then those other Madhyamikas back in India were the regular Madhyamikas. And I wanted to explain to you why, you know. They go into an explanation of why, all right? And Gyaltsev J picks on them for calling themselves great Madhyamikas later, as you might guess. So here we go. Those regular followers of Madhyamika are always saying that all existing objects are empty of any essence of their own. Rangingo Tomba, okay? Those regular Madhyamika guys are always saying that all objects are emptiness of any essence of their own, which is what the Madhyamika schools do say. Okay. What's the big version of emptiness for the mind only, by the way? Do you remember? Sung Zingi Zetoma? What is that? Yeah, subject and object are empty of coming from a separate seed, okay, which everybody can relate to, you know? One seed has created me to stand here. One seed has created Michael for me to see. Okay? So in a sense, we are one essence, one substance, which is not at all to say I'm Michael and Michael's me, or there's no difference between us. Okay? When we say object and subject are not different, we mean not different seed. You know? But But we are different in the normal ways, in the imputed ways. Okay. But if you didn't understand the mind-only school, you might think that that was the main idea of emptiness. That me and Michael, there's no duality between subject and object. Somehow I am Michael, Michael is me. And the illusion is that he seems to be separate from me. Well, they would say separate, you see. Separate seed I don't have a problem with. Separate from me I have a problem with, you see. They slipped, you see. And that, you know, you hear that so often, and it's so indefensible, and you don't go anywhere with that. Okay, so I'm Michael, where do I go now? You know, how do I practice that, you know? Like, so I'm the wall. You know, there's no difference between me and the wall. So where do you go with that? You know, how do you develop yourself? How do you practice Buddhism with that? And then people get frustrated and just kind of leave it, you know? And then they're looking for something else, you know? They're looking for something that has an application in your life, you know? Yeah, the wall's not as separate as I thought it used to be. The wall is a projection of my past karma. If I wanted a nicer wall, I could maybe provide housing for other people who come to Diamond Mountain, you know. That has applications, you see. That could lead to a Buddha paradise, okay? Anyway, all those regular Madhyamika guys, they say all existing things are empty of any essence of their own. And the lower schools, I think he's talking about the first two schools, Abhidharma and Logic, okay? They talk about the lack of self to a person, right? And they say there's a lack of truth to objects. Okay, lack of self to a person, lack of truth to objects. They talk about that individually, but they never get up to where we are. Okay. And those yoga systems, they speak about the wisdom that's beyond duality. Okay, they talk about it. Okay, but because all these views are still mistaken, I'm quoting Shendong Tatri, I'm quoting Jamgon Kongto's text, okay? They are far from enlightenment, like they got a long way to go, okay? The only people who can really have any experience of the wisdom free of duality are either people who are perceiving it directly or those whose minds are trained through meditating on nothing at all or on empty space, okay? Those are the... Forget the Abhidharma school. Forget the Sutra school. Forget the mind-only school. Forget the old Madhyamika school. You got to get up to the great Madhyamikans. Why? Because only we have the real experience of non-duality. How? We put our minds into a state of nothingness. You know? Forget this study. Forget this analysis. Forget this, like, you know, they say... Stop grinding your nose. Stop putting your nose to the grinding wheel. They say that. They just cool it. Just take it easy. Close your eyes. Meditate on... There's no big or small. There's no samsara nirvana. There's no antidote. There's no problem. Just put your mind into empty space. Okay? We're the only ones who understand that. So we're the great Madhyamika. Okay? The idea that analysis or contemplation on emptiness could be useful is a delusion. Okay? That's a quotation. Now, if you're in a debate ground and you were playing the Jonangba, you'd probably want to respond to that. You know, so I did, you know, all I meant, and he says it later on, he says another thing. He says, look, there's this guy. They never mention him, okay? Jetsun Kappa. He keeps talking about analyzing stuff, thinking hard about stuff, ripping stuff apart. You know, if you try to find this object that doesn't exist, you know, you'll never find it. It's too much sweat, too much logic, too much thinking, you know. Just get down and get into non-discursive thought, you know. That stuff is not meditation. You know, that's not meditation. And there's scriptural... foundation for that. We had it in the Yoga Sutra. Do you remember? Vitaka vichar anandasmita rupanugama samprajnata. Meaning, yeah, these four kinds of meditation just get you to the form realm. You know, trying to calm your mind down, trying to feel better, trying to tokchunyi, vitaka and vichara. You know, kind of looking at the object deeply, looking at the object not so deeply, but there's still no emptiness content to that. You're still in discursive mental thought process. No matter how far you go, without bringing up emptiness, you're still going to get caught in samsara. You're just feeling better. You know, you feel better, but you're not getting out of samsara. You don't have that emptiness element, you see, which everyone agrees is necessary to get out of samsara. So it's not like a crazy accusation, you know. Like they are taking this from the ancient scriptures, you know. Just put your mind on nothing, you know. Just don't think about anything, you know. Empty space. And you see that. Even like Western authors of Kagyu lineages, you see that. Even in modern books, you see, calm down, don't be so tense, you know, just relax, sit and meditate quietly, go on your breath, and then just empty space, you know. And when you get a problem with somebody or something comes up, just let go, you know. And it's a very common, that's where it's all coming from. It's all from old Jonangba. Yeah.
Isn't that the same argument with Kamala Shila in the Chinese?
Yeah. Qiangmei.
Years earlier?
Yeah. Qiang, Huashang.
Right.
Yeah, it is. The fact that they had the debate and the fact that Huashang almost won, it tells you that, you know, it's a common, and it's not crazy, you know. There is a place where you have to take reasoning and then get to the object, and then there's a difference between chegom and jogom, right? Analyze, conclusion, emptiness, jogom, fix on it. You know what I mean? There is a place for that. But they were very frustrated with Jetsun Kapa. What's this chegom stuff, right? What's the analytical meditation? What are you talking about? Meditation is a time for sitting and not thinking about anything. You know? And that was their, that's what distinguishes great Majjhimika from the others. They got all these theories, all these ideas, and they debate them and they think about them and rip them apart. But we sit down, we think about empty space, and that's it. You know, anybody else is far from Buddhahood. This is a quotation, okay? And we're just about done. I wanted to state formally four of Gyaltsev J's complaints. Okay, about Shentong. When he gets to the end of Shentong, he says, you know, I'm sorry to go so long on this Shentong idea, but so many people are thinking about it nowadays that I felt obliged, you know. When you read Jamgon Kongtrul's defense of Shentong, he says, so many people are attacking Shentong nowadays, I thought I should stop for a moment and just clarify it. You know? So, it's kind of cool, you get both sides of the... both of them are apologizing for going on, but they feel like it's necessary. Okay, so we're going to give four of Gyaltsev J's complaints. The wisdom which perceives that there's... I'm just going to say non-dual wisdom, right? The wisdom that sees that me and Michael are not separate is Buddha nature, is unchanging Buddha nature. That's Gyaltsev J's first complaint. We already talked about it, right? We already talked about that. The second is, we also went over already, if my mind is already the Buddha from the beginning, then it must possess the two kinds of purity. One, it's pure of self-existent things from the beginning, we all agree to that. Two, is it pure of all bad thoughts, negative thoughts? They have to say what? Yes, Buddha. That's the definition of the Sambhogakaya. The body which has the two purities. So then they're forced into saying, my mind from beginning of this time has not had mental afflictions. Okay. So we're already Buddhists. Here comes an interesting one. What's the Shen in Shentong? But what is that? Shenwangs and Kudoks. Everything in the room. Whether they exist or not. You know, like ideas that you have, concepts that you have, and also all the stuff that you can see here. And Buddha nature, or Shentong, is that which is other than those things. That which is empty of those other things, Shen. Okay? Buddha nature is the state of mind which perceives non-duality and is other. than those things. It doesn't possess those things anymore. So Gyaltsev Jay says, so let me get this straight. You're saying that this wisdom, which perceives non-duality, is free of normal stuff. And they say, that's what, yeah. Kunzop dembe tomba, dandan dembe yin. Yeah, ultimate reality is the absence of deceptive reality. Okay, so he says, now let me get this straight. Do you mean yinpa or yinba? Okay, in Tibetan it's a big difference. Are you saying it's not involved with deceptive reality? Or are you saying it isn't deceptive reality? Something other than deceptive reality. Is that what the Shen, is that what you're trying to get at? So it gives him two choices, right? It's a diamond deal. Two bad choices, right? So I'll say it again. Are you saying that like your version of ultimate reality like is just not involved with normal stuff? Right? Like yupa mayan, yupa tong. Or are you saying it's not normal stuff? Yimbe tong. Okay. Like which one are you talking about? You know, it has to be one of the two, right? And if they say, oh, ultimate reality means, Shen Tong means, empty of other meaning, it's just not involved at all with normal stuff anymore. It's beyond, you know. So he says, okay, so it's not Buddha nature anymore, right? So why'd you say that? Of course it's Buddha nature. Oh, so does it spread to every living creature? Does every living creature have it within them as part of their being from beginning this time? Well, yeah. Well, are they deceptive reality or ultimate reality? Well, they're deceptive reality. So is it like intimately linked with deceptive reality things since beginning this time? What do you mean it's empty of other things? What do you mean, Shen Tong? Okay, so that's his first problem. You got it? You okay on that one? Okay. What do you mean? What do you mean ultimate reality is empty of normal reality in the sense that they're not related at all? And he says, right, that's what I mean. Come on. You're saying that this is Buddha nature. You're saying Buddha nature spreads to every suffering living creature since beginning this time. What do you think they are? They're normal reality. What do you call it? It impregnates. How did you say it before? Pervades every single existing being. You can't say it's not connected to anything. You can't say it's empty of other, right? Empty of normal things. He says, oh, okay, I'm sorry. Let's take it back. Let's go the other way. Yinbe tong. It's empty of being. Ultimate reality is empty of being normal reality. Okay? That's what Shen Tong means, you know. Then Gyaltsev Jay says, did you have to write all these books just for that? You know, I mean, you say that you are great Majjhimikans, right? So you say that your disciples have somehow perceived something that other people couldn't perceive. Like they are Chedujawi Dujao, Wang Nun. They are spiritually advanced intellectual disciples, you know. So do you have to go through this whole thing to tell them ultimate reality is not normal reality? I mean, if it just means empty of normal reality, did you have to go through writing all these books just so they'd know that? Of course it's empty of normal reality. Of course it's different from normal. Shen Tong, right? I can buy that. Ultimate reality is different from normal reality. So then why do you call yourselves big Majjhimikas? Why do you say that everybody else didn't get it right and you and your disciples get it right? You know what? That's a no-brainer. He's just saying, come on, that's a no-brainer. Of course ultimate reality is empty of normal reality. Okay? Last one. You say that thinking and analysis are of no benefit in reaching the wisdom which is free of all duality, which can only be reached through thoughtless meditation. Why then do you undertake, for example, to explain your Shen Tong to people? If analysis and contemplation of emptiness is of no value, and if emptiness can only be approached in a mindless state of deep meditation, why'd you write your book? You know? Why are you trying to explain it to us? Okay. All right. By the way, these are, you know, to be really fair, you've got to have a Shen Tong person here to defend themselves. I'm sure they'd have answers, right? And then you'd have to go deeper. It's kind of mean to pick on somebody who's not there. I threw in two more points in the reading because I thought they were really beautiful. You know, we've been picking on Shentong tonight, but there's a beautiful part at the end of Jamgon Kontrol's text that I thought it would be beautiful to include in the reading. And, you know, Jamgon Kontrol was no dummy. He was extremely talented, brilliant writer, probably a Buddha, okay, Lama. And he says, these are his final advice for practice, like on the last few pages of the practical part of the book. Okay, he says, look, feel deep love and belief that the Lama who imparts these essential instructions to you is the Dharmakaya itself. Okay? Like, just believe. The last thing of all this debate, philosophy, stuff like that, he says, you get up out of your morning meditation, you go meet your Lama, you say, I meet the Dharmakaya. This is the Dharmakaya, you know. This is emptiness of the Buddhas, you know. Right there, you know, with great love and devotion. He says, you know, boom. I'm in the presence of the Dharmakaya, you know. That's technically illegal and practically perfect. Okay, right? I'm in the presence of the Dharmakaya. Okay. And then I love the next one. He says, reflect to yourself that since all living beings possess the Buddha nature, then whether you are able at this point to recognize it or not, they all ultimately combine within themselves all the qualities of an enlightened being. It just means, come on, the purpose of talking about Buddha nature, practically speaking, whatever you call it, doesn't matter. When you meet other people, just concentrate on that. This is an enlightened being about to happen. You know, this is an enlightened being about to go off. Especially if they're sitting in a class like this. You know, like when you get into a group like this and you're sitting with a bunch of people like this, just appreciate where you're all at. You know, look at them and say, my God, you know, we got 20, 30 people here about to break into enlightenment, you know, on the cusp, you know, and enjoy, you know, enjoy it. Walk around saying, God damn it, you know, those people on Tucson City Street, they got Buddha nature, Sangye Kyuriksu, Yubeichu, you know. Everybody walking around the streets got Buddha nature. You know, I'm lucky. We're lucky. You know, this is unbelievable, you know, and you got to think like that. Then he calls it Dakpa Ramjam. Dakpa Ramjam means like that Bodhisattva vow. 140? See everything as pure, you know. Just stop worrying about little differences between us, you know. Come on. Everybody walking around has got Buddha nature. The Iraqis have Buddha nature, you know. The terrorists have Buddha nature, you know. The Jonambas have Buddha nature, you know. Like, we all got Buddha nature, so just be happy and enjoy, you know, it's amazing, you know, and he's like, come on, you know, don't stick your head up your butt. Sometimes I think a lot of Buddhists have their head up their butt, you know, and it's like, come on, look where we're at. Everybody in this room's got Buddha nature. We're just about to become enlightened, you know, so have a good time. Okay. You know, somebody asked me this. Oh, when would you figure out that this view was wrong if you held it, right? And, you know, the Bodhisattva vows, the first one especially, Dr. Shinma, Shino Miteshing, you know, you can't criticize especially other schools of Buddhism. And if anybody's a deity on this planet, I'm sure Kondo Rinpoche was a deity. You see what I mean? Jamgon Kongdo. I mean, what are the odds? Someone who writes all this stuff, goes so deep, affects so many hundreds of thousands of people, and he's not a Buddha? Or he's not somebody special? You know... So, the question comes up in the monastery, you know, why do people like Maitreya present a mind-only school, you know? It's mistaken. It's slightly wrong, you know? Why do you get Maitreya teaching these wrong ideas, you know? Even about Buddha nature, you know? Why would Lord Maitreya do that? And there's a clue on the first page of Jamgon Kontro's scripture, and I kind of like it, you know? There's a clue right there on the front page, you know. It's kind of beautiful. He says, I'm going to quote him, okay. It's not that we make this distinction between literal and figurative teachings because there's any chance that some part of Lord Buddha's teachings could be intentional lies, you know. It's not like we say this is literal and this is figurative because we think Lord Buddha was a liar or that he's trying to mislead us, you know. What do you think, you know? It's just that different people have different capacities to see what the deepest teachings, you know. Different people have different capacities. You know, this whole three wheels thing, the three turning of the wheel thing, he says, it's just like, what does he say? Bhukkhase nyupa. Say bhukkhase nyupa. And I didn't know this word. I looked it up in the dictionary, you know. And it says, when a mother is trying to feed a piece of fruit, for example, to a child, and they can't stick it in their mouth and they can't bite it, they have to mash it. They have to make it all mush, like Gerber's baby food, you know. And then they have to, you know, like spoon it in. That's what Lord Buddha's doing. Come on, don't you get it? You know, you're being spoon-fed the baby Gerber stuff at first. You know, it's not that Lord Buddha's trying to lie or mislead you about Buddha nature when he talks about this clear light stuff and all that. He's just mashing it up for you so you can digest it. And then later you can get to solid food. You know? So the fact that he says that on the front page and then goes on to like 25 pages of indefensible emptiness teachings that are very attractive to many people is, I think, he's trying to say something, you know. That's my take on it. Okay.
What if you spend your whole life studying this? You say this is the way things are, et cetera, et cetera. Would that preclude you from a direct perception of emptiness because you're spending your time spacing out on the fiction?
I think it could be very dangerous, yeah. It could be very dangerous. But maybe for a person, they say who doesn't have the kawa, you know, they just don't have enough virtue yet. So you get them to do other things. Like at the end, he says, I don't care what you do, you know, look, just go make some water bowl offerings, you know, go build a stupa, go do, you know, something physical, you know, and dedicate it to seeing Rick, you see. Like he has a whole list of activities and he says, if Rick doesn't come to you easily, you have to go do some other things first and then Rick will come to you, you know. And he actually there mentions for the first and only time Gengyoki Rik, developable Buddha nature. He says, you got to develop it, you see. So, I think somebody told me, somebody at Vajrapani, which is a big Galupa center in the United States, that the former director said, it wasn't him, but a good friend of his, said, I never would have gotten into Buddhism if Trungpa Rinpoche hadn't taken me to all those drinking parties. You know, and people say bad things about, at least they used to, about Trungpa Rinpoche. You know, like 30 years ago, it was like a big scandal. Trungpa Rinpoche is just alcoholic and doing weird things. But he said, you don't know how many people ended up going there for the party. And then, you know, 6 months later, they're like studying Madhyamika. So, you don't know. We can't say, right? All right. We'll start. We'll stop. No. Yeah.